interested in calculating, the post-Newtonian corrections for the purpose of studying gravity waves. So we had developed this effective field theory formalism, which was based on a Lagrangian approach. Most people, the GR community, typically solves equations of motion. And we organize it in terms of effective field theory with some systematics. And I'm not going to go into it because it doesn't talk about it in my talk. But if you wanted to calculate Newtonian potential, post-Newtonian potentials, then you look at some classical source, and if you exchange one graviton, then you get Newton's laws. And then if you go.
And if you go to higher orders, then you would get, this is a V order V squared correction, so it's a non-relativistic potential, and blah, blah, blah. So we were able to make significant progress, and then some groups actually carried this out to order 3pn, which is V to the sixth. And if you start calculating diagrams, so this is 0pn, this is 1pn, and then if you start going to higher orders, 2pn. So 2pn, there's 16 diagrams. And at 3pn, things start to get messy. And there's about 100 diagrams. And then you go to 4pn, it goes to about 1,000. Okay. So the natural question is, there's this tremendous amount of progress that's been made in calculating scattering amplitudes. Right? We know Feynman diagrams are not the way to go. Right? Feynman diagrams encode a tremendous amount of baggage that you don't need. And if you calculate glue-glue scattering, you know, with, you know, five gluons, if you did it in Feynman diagrams, you would have these huge, disgusting expressions. But if you add them all up and just look at the Onshell S matrix, you'll find that it's one tiny little expression. So there's a huge amount of redundancy in the Feynman diagrams. So the natural question, so this leads me to what I was interested in, is I was interested in the question, well, can we use the same techniques to calculate these potentials without using Feynman diagrams? Now, on the face of it, it seems like the answer would be no, because all the techniques which are used to calculate scattering amplitudes are on-shell, and they're tree-level diagrams. These are off-shell and loop diagrams. Okay, so on the face of it, it would seem like the answer would be no. But if you could do it, then it would be a really powerful statement, for several reasons. No. Well, I'm saying that the fluctuating modes are coherent states. They're not like on-shell exchanges, right?
But if on-shell means satisfying classical equations, it is. But if it means perturbative in the things that your lines,
So these lines are all very far off shell, right? These are all off shell modes, right? They have no energy and no zero component of the four momentum.
But a different way of describing that same system is you've got two particles interacting with a classical gravitational field that you've got by solving the Einstein equation.
That's true.
And that's very classical.
Yeah, but
that's
correct, but that's not, I mean, so When you write down the matrix elements for these guys, right? There's some set of Wick contractions, and all the lines are off shell, right? If you want to calculate classical fields, right, a classical field is an off shell statement, right?
See, to me, it's an off-shell.
I think it's a question of terminology. You're saying that there's the classical fields are solutions to the Einstein's equations.
Yeah.
I would say I'm using the term on-shell. Any on-shell quantity is physical, is measurable. So I don't think that jives with how you're using the term. So an on-shell S matrix element is some physical quantity. These potentials are not physical in any sense, right? Right? They're gauge dependent and they're frame dependent. So that's how I'm using the term. So this is completely unphysical. The modes are off-shell, as opposed to an on-shell scattering amplitude where all the particles are on-shell. That's how I'm using the term. So 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 the question is, can we calculate using only on-shell amplitudes? Okay, and the original motivation was, of course, to just simplify these calculations. But the ramifications to this question are interesting because we know that when we calculate with on-shell amplitudes, we only need the three-point function. Okay. So one of the things we learned from calculating scattering amplitudes is that gravity, this highly nonlinear theory, which has n graviton vertices. So at 4pn, I've got to worry about, you know, a 6 graviton vertex like this. And those are incredibly complicated. But we actually know that when you calculate on-shell scattering amplitudes, completely irrelevant. You only need the three-point function, right? So all you need is the three-point graviton scattering, and you know everything. So Einstein's action is incredibly redundant, right? It's an infinite series of vertices expanded out when we linearize around some space. And all the stuff beyond 3 gravitons is irrelevant. So all those other vertices are completely encoded in the 3 graviton vertex. So what that's basically telling you is that all the complexities of Einstein's field equations are somehow should be simplified. They're not really there, right? So in fact, if we could calculate from the on-shell amplitude, so given the fact that the three-point function is fixed, is unique, and this can be proven just by looking at the. This was proven by looking at how it transforms under the little group. So if I just look at the little group transformation of the three-point amplitude along with Lorentz invariants, that fixes it uniquely. So basically, given this fact, we can construct all the amplitudes without knowing anything about Einstein GR. Yeah?
So are you stating this as a fact or as a consequence?
So this statement is a fact. These two statements are fact. That statement is a fact for calculating on-shell amplitudes. But the question is, what does this have to do with on-shell amplitudes? So I have to be able to use on-shell amplitudes to relate these to conclude that the gravitational potential between two bodies doesn't care about the Einstein action.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to understand is you're saying that the Heimdall protection when expanded perturbation theory.
Yes.
Really, everything is irrelevant beyond the three-point.
Right.
You're stating that as a matter of fact or as a matter of consequence.
So it is everything is irrelevant for beyond the three-point if you're calculating on-shell S matrix elements. That is a statement of fact. But I have it would be also irrelevant for calculating potentials if I can show how to use on-shell S matrix scattering methods to calculate these potentials.
Yeah. Is that up to some function of momentum you don't know, or is that?
No, it's exact. The only thing you don't know is the normalization.
So if I imagine calculating in a field theory, I could dream up some operator involving curvature Q or something that would contribute to the three-point function with a parameter.
I mean, you're saying I think that's.
That was just higher.
For complex momenta.
Yeah.
Yeah. The all plus of the all minus?
With just positive powers of the.
Yeah, with positive powers upstairs. Yeah, that's right. But I'm not sure if that answers what Cliff was interested in. Cliff's question is if I start adding a higher dimensional operators. Right.
Yeah.
But I can think to those pieces. But presumably they would have to be suppressed if they're being generated from going beyond the leading arc operator.
So the statement is that for some combinations of spins, it's unique, and for other combinations, there's a
freedom. If you have all, yeah, all pluses have these extra, there's an extra possibility to some arbitrary power of plus, 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 or minus, minus, minus. That's true.
What does she say about non-normalizability of Einstein graph?
Nothing. Still not renormalizable. Okay. What I'm going to show is that this statement is true. And under the following assumptions, so I should say that the relationship, so I'm going to make this statement that the potentials, and as a consequence of that, the metric in the probe limit, which I'll explain in a second, can be calculated from on-shell S matrix elements. And all I have to, the assumptions that are going to go into it are Lorentz invariance. So Lorentz invariance, locality. So these are the assumptions. And unitarity. Of course, they're not all independent. So I don't know how you want to do your counting of assumptions. Okay. So if I assume the theory is local, Lorentz invariant, and unitary, then I can calculate both the potentials as well as the metric, solutions to Einstein's equation, without ever writing down an action, without using a variational principle, or without assuming anything about the form of the action. Okay? So that's the claim. So what's interesting about this is, of course, that this is also true for Yang-Mills theory. So given the squaring relation, which relates Yang-Mills amplitudes to GR amplitudes, this implies there's a relationship between the classical solutions to Yang-Mills and the classical solutions to GR.
Are you going to close with an algorithm how to get from one to the other?
No. I don't know how to get from one to the other. All I know is I could give you an algorithm to go from one to the other, but it wouldn't be a very useful one. Because, well, what you have to do is, you know, when you construct the potential through the amplitudes, there's still some work you got to do. But then if you're going to, all you have to do is take the amplitudes and square them, but still you have to do all the work. So I'm not sure how direct, you know, what you'd really like to do is take one solution and go from here to here instead of going like that and, you know. No, so that's an interesting question. So I will construct solutions which are expansions in G Newton. So G Newton will be my expansion parameter. So the interesting question is that expansion asymptotic or not? And so this is an open question that I don't think anyone still knows the answer to. So Duff originally wrote this paper, or wrote a paper on this subject in the 70s or in the 60s. Where he started calculating using Feynman diagrams to calculate solutions, using all the nonlinearities and such, and he pointed out, well, look, there's a gauge in which the Schwarzschild solution is linear in G. So perhaps this is telling us that it is a convergent expansion, but that was sort of just a hand waving question. But if it is convergent, then in principle the answer is yes. But I don't know if anyone knows. I would assume it was asymptotic. That would be my first guess. So, yeah. Okay, so let me just show you a little flow chart about how I'm going to go about doing this. So my starting point is I'm going to assume assume there exists a massless spin 2 particles. That's my starting assumption. And that the theory is Lorentz invariant. So this starting assumption, so back in the 60s, or I think, I'm not sure, yeah, late 60s, maybe early 70s, Weinberg, of course, showed us that the existence of a massless spin 2 particle plus Lorentz invariance implies diffeomorphism invariance. Right? So that this starting assumption, it shouldn't surprise us that we could do this, right? And then he further showed that the equivalence principle and the necessity to couple to a conserved stress energy tensor is also a consequence of Lorentz invariance. So so this non-geometric approach to gravity was actually, he wasn't the first one to think about these issues. In fact, so it's an interesting story that's told in the preface to Feynman's book on GR, that there was an undergraduate at MIT named Krishnan who was the first one to work on this problem. So to completely eliminate geometry, try to eliminate geometry from GR, just think about in terms of just Lorentz invariance and Feynman diagrams. Apparently he went to Princeton to do his postdoc, and Einstein was there and did not look too fondly upon this approach, as you might imagine. Then he left and became an atmospheric scientist as a sort of consultant to the government and actually did important things on turbulence in the atmosphere. And he actually just died a few years ago. It was an interesting story. So basically, what we're saying is that the only assumptions you need in GR are, this is what Weinberg showed, are Lorentz invariance and the existence of a massless spin 2 particle, right? The diffeomorphism invariance is a consequence of the mismatch between the full Lorentz group and the little group, between the fields and the states, and that forces diffeomorphism invariance in order for you to eliminate this mismatch. So what I'm sort of doing today is I'm going to sort of complete the program by saying that you can actually, so instead of just deriving Einstein's equations from these basic assumptions, which is what Weinberg did in linearized and then Desser did in the nonlinearized, we're actually going to find solutions without even looking at the Einstein equation. So it sort of completes this approach of non-geometric approach to GR where Einstein is eliminated from the process completely. Right, that's what I was mentioning, right. Yeah. Okay, so if we allow for spin 1 or spin 2, so spin 1, spin 2, you can do this for both. So this is another way of also, you could also find solutions to Yang-Mills theory in the exact same way. So this leads to Yang-Mills theory. And this leads to GR. And these, of course, are related by double copy relations. Okay. Now the question is, how am I going to go from calculating scattering amplitudes in these two theories to the potentials? I'll start off by using BCFW to calculate on-shell S matrix on-shell S matrix elements. And then what I'll do is I'll use unitarity sewing relations to generate loop amplitudes. And then I will take that those loop amplitudes, and I'll take a limit of those loop amplitudes and match on to an effective field theory of, so we'll take the non-relativistic limit to match on to an effective field theory of potentials. And then, once I have the potentials, I know the geodesics. So if I know the geodesics, I know the metric. So from the potentials, if I wish, I can extract the metric from the geodesics. OK? So that's how the calculation works. So if I'm only interested in gravity waves, then I would just stop here. And this extracting the metric is more a matter of principle to show that solutions, classical spacetimes, can be derived directly from S matrices, which was the title of my talk. So what there are old papers by Donahue where he calculates quantum corrections to the Schwarzschild metric by expanding around it and doing loops. And there was a recent paper where they did, so they wrote a paper, Donahue and I forget what it was called, Bohr, actually wrote a paper that was very similar to ours that came out a few months later. Okay. So I probably don't need to go through BCFW because most of you are probably familiar with it, but there is one point that I want to make, and that I'm trying to emphasize that at no point am I going to ever use an action, or will I ever need to refer to a Lagrangian. And when you do BCFW, it's not completely true because, if we consider so the usual trick in BCFW is you take some momentum and you complexify it. And so the physical on-shell amplitude with real momenta, is related to this contour integral. And so this thing is the sum of the residues plus a possible contribution to infinity. Okay? And so normally in BCFW, if you want to relate these two equations, and you have to show that this guy's not there. Okay? And the way you usually do that is you look at the action and you power count it to make sure that the things die off sufficiently fast to infinity. So since I don't want to have to rely on an action, I have to somehow justify not keeping this piece. And the reason I don't care about this piece is this is coming at very large momentum. And the very large momentum piece can't contribute to a classical long-range potential. So the existence of this, I don't care if this is there or not, because even if it were there, it would be a purely quantum mechanical effect, which I'm not interested in because I'm only interested in classical fields. So that's the extent to which, we'll only need to talk about BCFW. Yeah, so that small parameter is h bar. Yeah, so there's h bar over L, where L is the angular momentum in those two states. So that's pretty small. So if you have two black holes, right? So this guy, this is a quantum mechanical effect, and the quantum effects are always suppressed by the angular momentum.
So some power of h over l.
Yeah, that's right. Is there a clock somewhere?
It's at
1:30. Just keep track. Okay. Okay. So, so the first step is to build up these on-shell S matrix elements, and then use BCFW. To generate what we need, and then sew together our tree-level diagrams and using unitarity to extract diagrams that look something like that, except not Feynman diagrams, but the topology would be the same. So this is quantum mechanical. The point is this allows me to use BCFW. In the classical limit, without need for an action. Okay. Okay. So, what do we need to build up our potentials? Well, I'm going to be interested in the scattering of a massive scalar with gravitons. If I were interested in generating the Kerr solution, then I would make them massive fermions. And this is actually something my student Varun Vaidya has worked out, where you use fermions on the external lines. And that, from that, you could build up the Kerr solution. But I won't talk about that today. So for our purposes, the only thing we're going to need is the graviton scalar three-point function. So this looks something like that, where Q is the reference vector for the graviton, and it turns out that's actually, so if I'm interested in calculating at one loop, which corresponds to 1pn. So 1pn will correspond to order v squared. Yeah. This is the 1/2. So now I'm using the usual spinner helicity notation. This is the amplitude for graviton, the three-point amplitude. So this is a graviton scattering with a massive scalar. Q is some null reference vector.
For those of us who are not entirely comfortable with don't use the notation every day. The bracket, can you just write this in terms of
These are just spinners, yeah. So this is just U left. That's what the numerator looks like. So this would be P1/ something like that. It's not important. It's not important for the rest of the talk, but I just wanted to emphasize that this is all you need to calculate. So what's interesting is you would think that, look at this diagram. I would need this to calculate. I don't even need, so at 1pn, you don't even need the three graviton vertex. You can get everything. All the nonlinearities are encapsulated just by this. So the Einstein-Infeld-Hoffman potential, which is the 1pn potential, that's all you need. You don't need anything else. You don't need to know anything else, which is kind of remarkable.
So in pedestrian terms, said Q mu, Q nu plus M, G mu nu or something as the vertex for a scalar of the graviton, you're putting that on shell?
These are all on shell, yeah.
But that's essentially what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the tree-level vertex.
Yep. Yep. And that's all you need. Okay, so the way we're going to use.
Why I'm saying this is so surprising, I mean, you could take I'm obviously misunderstanding the question, but if you just take one particle, your Yukawa exchange, you get your Yukawa potential.
Yep. Oh, that will give you the, yeah, so for Newton, that's not surprising. But for, so at leading order, if you were just, so if you just use this, this is going to give you GMM over R. But what's interesting is that this is all you need to get at next order. So if you're calculating Feynman diagrams, you would calculate, you would have to include this diagram, right? But you don't need that, actually. All you need is this. So this is the V squared correction to the Newtonian potential. That's called the Einstein-Infeld-Hoffman potential. And it doesn't even need any of the nonlinearities of GR.
So your vertex was a non-relativistic scalar, not a scalar.
Yeah, the non-relativistic scalar. Massive. And we're going to take the small velocity limit. So in fact, it would seem surprising that you don't need this potential at 1 p.m. But actually, there was a paper within the context, if you use Feynman diagrams, but break the metric up into Kaluza-Klein variables, in terms of those variables, there's a choice of gauges where that's true. So that was a paper by Cole and Smolkin from a few years back. So the fact that this turns out from BCFW tells you you don't need this is completely consistent with what they found previously. Okay? So what we need to do is calculate the so at leading order you'll just have the Newtonian potential from throwing these two guys together. But next we need 2-to-2 scattering. And I know how to generate 2-to-2 scattering from just sewing these two guys together using BCFW. Okay, so this scattering amplitude, I could write down for you. So we have, so using the BCFW, okay, so that, for instance, if I take this to be plus plus, then that's what the amplitude looks like. And I can get that by just using BCFW, so I don't actually calculate any Feynman diagrams, right? Now, the reason, you could ask the question, why, so the P of Z is flowing through here. Why don't I need the three graviton vertex? And the answer is, if in principle there would be a topology where you needed it. So for instance, you could ask, well, why doesn't this contribute? And the answer is because it doesn't have a pole in Z, because the complex momentum doesn't flow through here. So that's why the three graviton vertex doesn't contribute to the scattering amplitude. So in the BCFW equation, you sum up all the residues of the poles, but that contribution has no pole. So that's why the three-point amplitude does not contribute. OK? So I have, there's another one for the minus minus and the plus minus. And so now I have to, what I do is I take these guys and I sew them. Okay, so what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is you literally, so you take these guys, which are on shell, and you lift the cuts. So these guys are two on shell amplitudes, right? But now I'm going to lift the cuts, and I'm going to replace my delta p squared by 1 over p squared. Okay, so that's called sewing by lifting the cuts. Okay? So you could ask a question, for instance, why don't I have, so this is a T-channel cut. But I could also have an S-channel cut that looks like this. I could lift these cuts as well. But it's fairly straightforward to see that these are purely quantum mechanical effects. So I won't need to worry about those, and all I need to do is sew together in this channel. Okay? So this is the straightforward exercise, and you sew them together, it gives you a collection of scalar integrals. Okay? So this set of cuts gives you a collection of scalar integrals. Now, so what's interesting, of course, is the first question you should be asking me is, how these are both one-loop diagrams, and we've always been taught that we count powers of H bar by loops, right? So how can it be that the T-channel cuts are classical and the S-channel cuts are quantum mechanical? What's that?
When you're tracking factors of one, that's what happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, so the answer is that they all are proportional. They're both proportional to H bar. And in fact, the T-channel cut will contain both classical and quantum contributions. So the counting of H bar is misleading because when you're done, you want to calculate a potential, you have to Fourier transform. And when you Fourier transform, it'll be inhomogeneous in H bar. So some will pick up powers of 1 over H bar and others won't in the Fourier transform. So, okay, so this generates a collection of integrals. Scalar integrals. And at one loop, you have bubble topologies, triangle topologies, and boxes. Okay? And we're only interested, so the nice thing about doing things this way is when you're only interested in classical physics, life's a lot easier because you can drop a lot of stuff. So the bubble graphs are ultraviolet divergent and are purely quantum mechanical, so you don't need them. The box graphs are also quantum mechanical, and I'll explain why in a little bit. In particular, if you look at the momentum region where these are potential, where these modes have zero energy, which is what we're interested in, then this generates a phase, and that in fact is responsible for the Coulomb phase. So this is just an iteration of two Coulomb exchanges. Okay, and if we have time, I'll go into a little bit more detail about that. So all you have to do is take your sewn together on-shell amplitudes, look at the integrals, pull out the triangles, and now you have the classical contribution. It still has a quantum mechanical contribution as well. So in fact, the general form of the amplitude or the integral, I can write as g m1 m2 over q squared. And then there'll be some series in g q m. And then possible corrections, which are okay. So these are just V corrections. And these corrections are of the classical form. So any classical, I claim that any classical contribution is of this form. And you, in this case, you can actually just can't count powers of h bar. So if you just do on dimensional grounds, here's the Newtonian potential. This guy has no powers of h bar, and these are just powers of c. So any deviation from this form of any diagram is necessarily quantum mechanical. Now, what's interesting is, in fact, what I said here is not completely true, in that there can also be logs. Now, this is really interesting. Some power here. So how can logarithms occur in classical potentials? Right? You think, oh, there's got to be a divergence, and there's got to be a scale, right? So how, you have to do, there's got to be a log q squared over mu squared. That looks very quantum mechanical, right? Dimensional regularization, the scale, dimensional transmutation. But this is really a fact of there are classical logarithms in any nonlinear field theory that are, in fact, due to dimensional transmutation. And the reason is because when we take two black holes and we treat them like point particles, we're taking a very singular limit, right? And that singular, so we're taking some finite size object and treating it like a point. So if I calculate a diagram that looks like this, then when I integrate over all the positions of this vertex, I'll have to integrate over that point, and that point will generate a singularity. And that will generate a logarithm. So the question is, what does that mean? Does that make any sense at all? And the answer is yes. It's because that must mean there's some higher dimensional operator in the effective theory that has to absorb that UV divergence. And those higher dimensional operators in the effective theory, which I have not discussed, will absorb that divergence. So that does allow for the existence of classical logarithms. And those higher dimensional operators will have Wilson coefficients that will be C of mu, such that the mu dependence cancels. So that's a little interesting side note on classical effective field theories and RG. So contrary, perhaps, to public opinion, the RG is not unnecessarily unique to quantum mechanics. Okay. Okay, so the next step, so what I want to do is, what I'm going to do is take this integral and extract the piece that has this generic classical form. And the way we do that, well, one way to do it is to actually do the full integral. But you actually don't even need to do the full integral, because the full integral includes quantum mechanical corrections, which don't have that form. So if you calculated that triangle integral and expanded it in small q, you would find that there were some terms which didn't have that form. And the question is, why? So if you look at the, let's consider the scalar integral. Oh, let me draw it differently. Okay, so that's the scalar integral we're interested in. It's an overall 1 over q squared, which is the momentum transfer. Okay? So this integral has, and in principle, there could be some numerator, could be a tensor integral. So let me put in some function of k, q, and p. This integral, so how does this integral contain both quantum mechanical and classical contributions? And the answer is certain regions of the loop momenta are classical and certain regions of the loop momenta are quantum mechanical. So if I do this integral in epsilon dimensions, there are essentially a few regions which contribute. So there's the regions So there's one region where all the hard region, where k is of order m. Okay, and that in that region, everything is independent of q. You can just drop q, it's subleading. So it can't possibly, it's a completely contact interaction, which can't possibly be a classical long-range force. So you can drop the hard region, so that's purely quantum mechanical. Yes, h bar over L. Right. And there's another region where k0 is 0 and k is of order p. This is called the potential region. Okay? And the potential region is what's going to contribute the classical effect. And in fact, it's kind of interesting to see what happens. So we can sort of see what happens in, so let me expand this thing around the potential region. So in the potential region, I asymptotically expand my integrand. So what I've done there is just kept the leading terms. So I've dropped k0 wherever it's subleading. So k, remember, the k0 is much, much less than k. Now, if you look at this integral, it looks very poorly behaved because the k0 integral is not well defined. Right? It doesn't converge. But let me consider putting in a convergence factor. I'm going to take the limit where eta goes to 0. And if I do this integral, then I end up with d3k k squared k plus q squared. So what this effectively has done is eliminated this and inserted classical sources on the ends. It's eliminated the propagation, the quantum mechanical, all the quantum properties of the black hole, which we don't want because we're talking about macroscopic black holes. It doesn't fluctuate. It doesn't have a propagator. Just eliminates the propagator and turns it into two potential propagators coupled to classical sources. So that's what you would get in classical source theory. So it gives you a nice intuition that if you concentrate on the potential region of the loop, it automatically comes out to look like a classical calculation. Okay? Okay, so we've taken this integral, we've asymptotically expanded the potential region, we've done the integral, and we're left over with some result. And we have to know what to do with it. So what does that result have to do?
You have a trivial question about the h-bars.
Yeah.
So you have an h-bar in front because it's a loop.
Yeah.
But then it gets cancelled by the one over h-bar that comes from the Fourier transform.
Correct. Yeah. OK, so now we have a result for our diagram. So so the result for this amplitude is going to look something like, I'm not going to write it down in detail. is going to look something like, it's going to look like G squared, and then the right powers of M. And then it's going to be a factor of 1 over Q. And then there's going to be some function of M1, M2. And if I want to keep higher order corrections in V, I can also keep some dependence on as well. So I'm not going to write it down, but the important thing to see is that this is going to generate a 1 over R squared potential. So this is the first correction to Newton. Okay. But this is not the true potential, because you have to define what you mean by a potential. So this is the full theory result. And the potential is defined in an effective field theory. Where the effective field theory is an effective field theory of scalars. So you have L is going to be some phi. So there's a sum over I, and there's a VI of P minus P prime. So these are a set of potentials in an effective field theory. So this effective field theory is just an effective field theory for a massive scalar at low energy. So this is a non-relativistic effective field theory with the usual, you know, leading order kinetic action. Let me call this L potential. And the potentials, these guys are just matching coefficients. That's the right way to think about it. They're Wilson coefficients in the effective field theory. And so now what we have to do is take the full theory result and match it onto the effective field theory to extract the potentials. Okay? So the reason that's important to understand is that if you want to calculate a subleading potential like we are here, so the leading order potential, of course, is just Newton. Right, so this is just Newton. There are corrections to Newton that come from velocity squared corrections. So there's things that go like 1 plus p squared over m squared, which still come from this diagram, from relativistic corrections to this diagram. So when we match at subleading order, we have to, so v is going to be the full theory minus the effective theory result, where you have to include subleading pieces. So there's effective theory diagrams that look like this, where now this is the v squared correction potential. This is Newton. And there's also diagrams that look like this, where now you have to include relativistic corrections to the propagators. So this is the matching procedure you would do in any effective field theory. So if you want to calculate a subleading potential, you have to take the full theory, calculate the effective theory, and take into account that the effective theory has its own subleading corrections. Right? So this is an insertion. This is this operator here. For instance, that's this. So this is Newton plus a correction. That's just Newton. And this is the p to the fourth over m cubed correction to the kinetic energy. OK, so that allows us to extract the potential. And indeed, if you do that, you get back the well-known result that you could get using other methodologies. So now, at least the technical part of calculating, so what I've shown so far, hopefully, is the I'm not going to write it out. It's just the usual Einstein-Infeld-Hoffman potential, although you have to change coordinates to see agreement with the standard calculations. So now what we've shown is that without using anything about gravity, we've calculated the 1pn potential. And if you wanted to calculate the 2pn potential, you could do that as well. And you wouldn't have all the issues of Feynman diagrams are not there. So in principle, the 4pn potential, which involves 1,000 Feynman diagrams, you would be able to do much more quickly if you chose to. The only hard part there, of course, would be, so at 4pn, there are some scalar integrals that you need to do that no one really knows how to do yet. So now let's extract the metric. So I promised you I would show you how to get the solutions. But as we said, if we know the geodesics, we know the metric, at least as an expansion in G squared. So first thing we'll do is we'll take the probe limit. That is, we'll take M1 is much, much bigger than M2. So we'll just try, we'll look at the field generated by M1, and M2 will drop anything which isn't linear, beyond linear order in M2. So the action we'll write it out like this. And this, so this is going to be the M2 guy. And these guys are a function of M1. Right? So and this we know is the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. So these g's a function of M1 and R. So M1 and R. So all I have to do to get the metric out, so let me make an ansatz. G00 is 1 plus AI lambda I. I'm going to lambda VI, where lambda is G M1 over R. And similarly, I could write all the possible form factors. And G0i is 0 by symmetry. Okay? So now all I have to do is take my potential, which I did not write out here, right? Whatever potential I got, then match to extract the coefficients of A, B, and C by plugging in here, right? And in so doing, I conclude that C1 is 0, A1 is minus 2, A2 is 2, B1 is 2, and this is just Schwarzschild. At order G squared. Okay? So then you could calculate the arbitrary order in G that you wished. As a matter of principle, you would reproduce the Schwarzschild solution, assuming that the expansion was not asymptotic. The Kerr solution follows, as I said before. So my student, Varun Vaidya, he calculated the Kerr solution by looking at two spinners. Sorry, I take it back. So he calculated the spin 1, spin 2 potentials by looking at two spin one half particles and then relating so to the spin of the black hole. And if you wanted to calculate the Kerr solution, you would actually have to look at spin one particles, because a Kerr solution has an intrinsic quadrupole moment, and to get the quadrupole, you would need a spin one particle. So, so I think the last part is just a formal statement that I found interesting about the redundancies of gravity and the fact that, so where did my assumptions go in? So Lorentz invariance was clear. Locality, where did I assume locality? Well, BCFW assumes locality. It assumes that all the poles are due to on-shell particles which can exist in asymptotic states. So, or you can call that unitarity. Locality and unitarity give me a headache whenever I try to distinguish the two. So the weakness, of course, here is, so I could say, well, I can just replace GR. I don't need GR anymore. And of course, that's not true, because I'm assuming asymptotic flatness, right? And I'm also, of course, assuming that I can calculate in some reasonable expansion. So if you wanted to use fine solutions which are not asymptotically flat, then that would be a challenge, right? Because I'm assuming the existence of an S matrix, right? So, and I'm expanding around flat space. So if you wanted to try to find the De Sitter solution, then I think that would be a challenge. So I'm not completely willing to abandon general relativity quite yet. As far, of course, as calculating for the purpose of phenomenology, I think this is a very useful trick that could save a tremendous amount of time in calculating higher order corrections in much the same way that we've learned about scattering amplitudes in particle physics. Yeah. So you cannot get potentials. That's not the Schwarzschild solution, right? That's the solution in the field of two backgrounds, of two black holes, and the exact solution is not known. The part about building the Schwarzschild solution was strictly a formal issue that I wanted to show that I didn't need Einstein's equation. All I needed was, you don't need an action. All you need is Lorentz invariance, essentially. So that part was just a formal statement that we can learn something more about gravity. But calculationally, the fact, I mean, we don't know what the solution is. There's no exact solution for two black holes, right?
So this is, at the practical level, this formalism would be useful if we wanted to do the 4 p.m. story.
That's right.
To get professionals to do that.
Right.
You're saying that if you were having to do it, this is the
vision. This is how I would do it. Yeah, I mean, because I wouldn't have to add. I mean, so what they do, the 3 p.m. people took what Walter and I did, and the people who have done it at 3 p.m. are working on it at 4 p.m. And they put it on a computer, and they generated, you know, all the Feynman graphs, you know, like people used to do in particle physics in the old days.
Right.
So like 5 years ago.
Get in there quick and do that 4 p.m. thing.
Oh, I don't know about quick.
Quicker.
I think it would be quicker, but the problem with the 4 p.m. is that there are a couple of scalar integrals that nobody knows how to do. So this.
In what sense do you mean that people don't know how to do them? Analytically? Or
analytically. Or? Yeah. No.
Numerically.
Yeah. Numerically wouldn't. It's not an issue. I actually wouldn't be surprised if some of the experts in higher loops in particle physics, if they put their mind to it, could do it. But no one in that community that I know of, at least, has looked at it. So I wouldn't be surprised if someone like Smirnov could sit down a couple of days and figure it out. But just guessing.
Any questions? Is that the last time?